Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Hello, everyone, and happy Labor Day weekend to everyone. I hope you're enjoying the heat. Labor Day is kind of a bittersweet weekend, I think, because even though we know we have a couple of weeks left before summer is officially over, it kind of feels like it's over. It feels like we're ending a bunch of things. It feels like we're putting away sandals and flip-flops and all our white shoes and our white clothes, buying school supplies, getting back to business, maybe getting back to school. And the days are getting shorter, and it's kind of sad because I love the summer. And although I love the fall, we know what comes next, especially in Chicago. But anyway, it's a time for new beginning. In fact, I feel that Labor Day is sort of the more so to me than New Year's, where people feel like they need a new start. The year ends and there's a new year beginning. It's kind of hard to start when it's 20 below in Chicago. So I feel like Labor Day, the day after Labor Day, is my new beginning for the year and getting down to business, making some resolutions, and moving through the rest of the year. I don't know, Roger, do you put away your white shoes and your white clothes, or are you one of those sandals until it snows persons?
Well, I wear sandals as much as possible, but I was going to tempt fate tomorrow. I'm going to wear my white slacks to work tomorrow here in the evening. So it's not quite after Labor Day, but it's approaching after Labor Day. So I'm going to do that and see how the rest of my year goes. I don't want to get any bad vibes out of it.
Jerry asked me this today. He said, if you wear white during the summer, it's white. But if you wear white in the winter, it becomes winter white. And what the heck's the difference? Because it's true. Like, you can wear white in the winter and it's okay as long as it's winter white. But what's the difference? Is it the fabric? Maybe the fabric's heavier, right?
You have a point on that. You would wear a lighter fabric during the summer, especially my white slacks are long slacks. They're not shorts. So, but they're a heavier material.
Yeah, I think that's the main difference.
Yeah, but I've been wearing them all summer. And I'm going to tempt fate, but I will be wearing my sandals with them.
Well, we should all hope, as long as you're not wearing black socks, we are okay with that, Roger, because we know that the sun rises and falls with Roger Badish fashion sartorial decisions. I was reading the newspaper at breakfast this morning, and I turned over, it was an old newspaper from the weekend. It was a USA Today weekend edition. And on the back, I really loved this ad, and it also brought up some legal questions for me. Did anyone see this? It's a full-page ad on the back of one of the sections, and it's all pink, and it says RESPECT at the bottom with an emblem of the Cadillac emblem. All pink with the Cadillac at the bottom. It says respect, and then it says 1942 to 2018. And I thought, what a great marketing tool this was. So Cadillac paid for this entire page, just pink. Didn't say Aretha Franklin, didn't say anything else, but it was, in honor of the pink Cadillac and the song that she sang by that title. And it reminded me of the situation we had in Chicago. Do you remember when Michael Jordan's name was used by Dominick's Food Stores?
Yes.
Yes.
On their coupon. It was a coupon, wasn't it?
And I went back and looked at it because I wanted to recall exactly what it was, but it was a large part of the newspaper. I don't know if it was a full page or a half page, but it had congratulations, Michael Jordan, you are a cut above. And it didn't have his picture. I think it just had his number jersey number. Mm-hmm. And then on the bottom there was, you're right, a coupon for, I don't know, something percent off of meat of some type, being like a cut above. And Michael Jordan hired an attorney. I knew the attorney who did it. I actually had him on my show. And he sued. It went all the way to court, in federal court, and went to a jury trial. And I believe he got somewhere around $8 million from the jury for use of likeness.
Mm-hmm.
His use of his name and his likeness for commercial gain without his permission. And it was very interesting because there was an explanation that Michael Jordan's image and his name are so valuable, and he has been very careful over the years to use them very, very limited, in a limited way. I think Fruit of the Loom was one of the sponsors that he lent his name to, and of course Nike and all of those sports items. But the idea was that if they were allowed to use his name, it would dilute his brand, and that brand would be worth less than it is. And he won, and he convinced the jury of that. I don't know where the money went. If it went to charity, I think he said.
I think he did do a charity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at this ad with, it doesn't say Aretha Franklin, but certainly we know that Aretha Franklin was intended by
right.
this. And it was in it. Now it doesn't, there's no coupon on this. It doesn't say Aretha Franklin. It doesn't say anything other than R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
But it does have her dates of birth her death, her passing date.
So it being a lawyer, you can't just enjoy things, right?
Yeah,
you can't just enjoy a really great ad and say this is really cool. I say to myself, could her estate, if her estate wanted to, could her estate sue and say they are using her likeness or her a reference to her, whether it's direct or indirect, to promote
the Cadillac.
But then I thought, did she get permission from Cadillac when she did her song Pink Cadillac?
Was there a pink Cadillac in the song? I bet you she, well, I don't know. I can't bet because she didn't even leave a will.
Well, she didn't leave a will.
So we don't even know if she has an estate looking out for her interest.
That's right. Anyway, I was just a thought.
That is interesting.
Just a thought.
Yeah.
We have an interesting show. Now, as everyone knows, the nation is turning their attention to the Chicago courts. This week starting, we have the Jason Van Dyke trial. He's the police officer who was accused of first-degree murder of the shooting of Laquan McDonald 16 times a couple years ago on the streets. And he's going to trial this week. There's been some gag orders. There have been some motions. Jury selection is supposed to start. We're going to find out if the case will be transferred to a different venue based upon jury selection. And we're going to probably see opening arguments starting very soon. So I wanted to cover it in an interesting fashion. We have Judge Richard Neville, who is a retired judge. He presided over the Duwalaby case, which was a very interesting case in Chicago back in the 90s. And he's going to talk a little bit about what you do in high-profile cases and what judges do to ensure that jury selection is done properly and that you get an impartial jury. And then after that, we have Laura Scarry, who is an attorney who represents police officers. And we're going to talk about strategy. What does the law actually say about a policeman's shooting? It's different than self-defense of an average person. The peace officers have a whole different set of rules that apply to them, and we're going to talk about what that is, and then we're going to talk about the strategies involved in representing a police officer in jury selection and during the trial. And then, of course, a little bit after 8 o'clock, we'll get to your legal questions. So put this in your phone, 312-981-7200, 981-7200. And I want to end this segment before we go to break with a musical interlude that reminds me of the end of summer. Take it, Frank.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea. It lingered there to touch your hair and walk with me. All summer long we sang a song and then we strolled that golden sand. Two sweethearts and the summer wind.
As I said, the Laquan McDonald murder trial is happening this week. It's starting on Wednesday. There will be jury selection, and there will be all kinds of motions heard, and it should be a very, very interesting trial, and I think the nation is going to be watching what happens here in Chicago. With us to talk about, from a judge's standpoint, what happens in a trial like this is Judge Richard Neville. Judge Neville has been an attorney for 52 years. He was a judge in Cook County for 13 years, where he presided in the criminal division hearing very serious felonies and murder trials. He's now an arbitrator and mediator with the prestigious JAMS in Chicago, the largest alternative dispute resolution provider in the country. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I'm really happy that you are joining us. So you're watching. Have you watched a little bit of the coverage of this case?
Yes.
Okay. And when you watch Judge Gaughan deal with this high-profile case, does it kind of bring you back to your dealing with high-profile cases and some of the considerations that you had in how to balance some of the rights here?
Sure. It's a difficult thing to have a case like he has, and it's a big responsibility to try to bring justice and fairness to a trial. Things have changed a lot since I was in the criminal court. We didn't have social media back then. So there's all types of things that I see and hear about this case. And, of course, one of the issues is how do you get a fair and an impartial jury? How do you find out from a juror whether they are able to be fair? What kind of questions do you ask them?
So we have the right to a fair trial, which is a constitutional right,
right.
And a right to a jury by your peers, an impartial jury. And then you have rights for the media to see what's going on, to have transparency or whatever the word is, to have people understand the system. I think particularly in a case like this where we had about a year go by where we never saw this tape and we didn't have a charge at all for over a year. How do you balance those two things? Because they're both very important.
Well, it's if you're just talking about the media, what's the media's rights and what are the media's interests? They want all the information as soon as they can get it. And sometimes they have opinions about it. Sometimes they just report the facts. So for a judge, and I assume you're talking about gag orders at
right.
this point, because that's what Judge Gaughan has done from time to time. So gag orders are, they're not totally unusual. There's gag orders off and on. But in a case like this, I think after a certain period of time, he thought it would be better to do some of the conversations with the lawyers in chambers, and it would give him a better handle on the facts. It would give him all the information he needs, but it did exclude the media from having information.
You know, it's interesting. I did a little research about pretrial publicity, and I know that lawyers want to get their clients out there to be human and to maybe talk a little bit about their side of the issue. And I think Jason Van Dyke was interviewed by Fox, local Fox, this week and by the Tribune. And as a result, there was a motion filed for violation of this gag order. And when you watched him, and actually, maybe we can play a little bit. Ben, can we play a little bit of the Jason Van Dyke interview just so we get, if you missed it in the media, what he has to say?
Taking a person's life, how did you deal with that?
That's what I mean. That's taking a person's life is not something I take lightly at all. It's, you know, it's, you know, it's a, you know, it's it, it it's very conflicting with, you know, religious beliefs. I never would have done this if I didn't think my life or somebody else's life was in danger.
Saw it as one of two choices.
Yes.
And on and on. And if anyone's interested, it's all over the Fox website, and portions of it are played throughout and are going to be played throughout. So the idea was that, and you can't help, I don't know if you watched any of it, but you can felt sorry for him. Now, you can feel sorry for him because he's in this predicament, or, you know, you can feel sorry for him because of what he's being charged with. But in any event, he's facing a lot of trouble in his life, and his family is, too. Do you think that this kind of thing could impact the jury pool?
Well, if it does impact the jury, then maybe those people who have been impacted would tell the judge that they can't be fair. They've already made up their mind about the verdict that should be rendered in this case. And that's a long, hard slog that the lawyers and the judge and the defendant will have to go through trying to figure out how do we get an impartial jury. So whatever he said at this point, there's First Amendment rights issues about whether you can speak out on your own behalf. There's also a judge's gag order. The state has asked for a motion to revoke, if not revoke his bond, increase his bond. And he's put that over, I think, until either the jury selected or during during the selection of the jury.
So let's go to the jury selection process. The lawyers get their chance to do voir dire, which is jury selection, asking the jurors questions to try to get to the idea of if they can be fair. And let's just be clear about this, Judge. It doesn't. The rule is not that we get a jury with people who never heard of the case, right? That's not what we're looking for. That's not what the requirement is.
It's difficult to say exactly what the rule ought to be, but it's pretty unusual if someone is from Cook County, where the jury will come from, that they haven't heard about this case or this matter in one way or another.
But as long as they say that they can be impartial, that's the key, correct?
If they can say and mean truthfully that they are impartial, that's what everybody is looking for this jury. That's everybody who's in the courtroom. There's lots of commentary both in the media and radio, TV, newspapers about this case, and lots of people will have thoughts about what they think is right or wrong. Obviously, there's the family of the man who was shot. They have one impression and one thought about this case. The police officers who were on the street that night, I don't know how many of them are going to testify, but they have some thoughts about what was going on. Hopefully, the jury will be 12 people who can put aside whatever they've heard outside and depend just on what they hear in the courtroom. That's the plan. Anyway.
That's the plan. You've presided over cases. What I mean, just from a gut feeling, you know, people do jurors take their obligations seriously when they are charged with being impartial, with being fair, following the jury instructions, even if they don't like what those jury instructions tell them they have to do what the law is? Do you have confidence that jurors can largely put aside their personal preferences and prejudices?
My experience has been, and I was a prosecutor, then I did defense work, then I was a judge. Hearing criminal cases, I would say that most judges and I think most lawyers believe the jury tries to do the right thing. Sometimes the lawyers are very interested in winning their cases, so they may disagree with verdicts. But in terms of what we hope that the jury will always do is consider the law and the facts, listen to the arguments, and then do the best job they can to render fair verdict. And I believe that they try to do that. The key is, can you pick a jury that's impartial, where you get 12 people who start with that as their premise? We're going to be fair. We're going to listen to the evidence. Everybody has probably seen, everybody my age anyway, seen the movie 12 Angry Men.
Right.
And it's a very good movie to kind of establish people get picked on juries. But when the discussions in the jury room occur, lots of emotion happens. People get vested in certain facts or certain ideas. And if they're able to put those aside based on conversations with the other jurors, that's really how the system should work.
And one last question about, you know, this. It's possible that Van Dyke chooses to have a bench trial, and that the jury, there's not going to be a jury, and they're going to opt for the bench trial. I think that's still on the table, and that's still a possibility. How would a judge in Judge Gaughan's position feel about this racially charged, nationally watched trial? I mean, with so many people having opinions about what should happen to this police officer, and so many people being polarized about this, is this something that weighs heavily on a judge?
I'd say very heavily. However, Judge Gaughan is not a new judge. He's not somebody who hasn't been through trials and tribulations with all kinds of cases. So it would be better for an experienced judge to get this case, whether it's a bench trial or a jury trial. So I can't speak for him, of course, but I think that's an important decision to be made in this case.
I get a sense just from knowing practitioners who practice in front of him that he's a pretty courageous guy, and he is pretty strong-minded, and he will make up his, if he is the arbiter of the fate of Jason Van Dyke, that he will be as fair as he can and not really take into account whatever pressures are coming from the outside world.
Well, it's easier for a judge to do that because the judge can take his own experience and his own reading of the facts, and probably it's easier for a judge to be impartial going into a trial, not invested as the lawyers are in winning the case, and maybe some of the jurors in thinking about this as a social issue as opposed to a criminal case against a defendant.
Now, I know you presided over the David Duwalaby, Cynthia Duwalaby case. And
A long time ago,
back in the 90s. And I'm going to have you back on to talk about it. I'm going to do a little kind of a recap of some of the cold cases in Chicago, the Karen Kupcinet case, the Valerie Percy case, the Tylenol murder trial, the Lane Bryant trial. But I'm going to have you back, and I look forward to seeing you. And I just want to give out your information. You are an arbitrator mediator with JAMS. You're one of the top people in that very prestigious organization. Can you give out your contact number for anyone who might want their cases arbitrated or mediated?
Well, I didn't come on this show to do this.
No, but I always give everyone an opportunity.
Okay. 312-655-9191.
Judge Richard Neville, thank you so much.
Okay.
Have a great night. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
If you have a legal question for Karen Conti, Karen will be taking your calls at the top of the hour, and she won't even charge you. Call 312-981-7200. That's 312-981-7200.
Welcome back. We're talking about the Jason Van Dyke trial coming up in Chicago this week. I believe that it's going to be, there's going to be cameras in the courtroom, and we're going to be watching at least portions of it, if not all of it. And we're going to have a jury selection starting this week. And with us tonight is a special guest who's going to be talking a little bit about how you represent police officers and what are some of the interesting considerations there are. Joining me is Laura Scarry, who is a partner in the law firm of Diano and Scarry. The focus of her practice is representing police officers and agencies in matters of excessive force, deadly force, search and seizure, failure to train, and racial profiling. She was a police officer herself for 6 years. She is a certified force science analyst, and she teaches for the Police Law Institute, providing training for law enforcement. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's nice to have you. And I'm really interested in getting to the issue of how do you prepare a trial like this? So you get hired to represent a person who is charged with a crime like this, or maybe a civil action, you know, similar types of things. How do you start putting your case together, and what are you looking for?
Well, I think in this case, there are two key factors that we have to take into consideration. And, of course, the biggest factor is the evidence, and I think we all can agree that the video footage, in particular, the one, is extremely important in this case. And then the other thing that the defense has to do is they really have to make a considerable effort to humanize Jason Van Dyke. So those are extremely important in this type of a case. Regarding the video, the defense should stress that the video was merely a small piece of the puzzle in determining the truth of what happened. I think we can all certainly agree that the video will have a tremendous impact in the case, but it is certainly not representative of all, nor does it provide a full account of what transpired. Those other pieces of the puzzle will obviously be filled in by witnesses, witness accounts of what transpired both before and during the incident, and as well as other video footage, and as well as the police testimony. So, and of course, the most important piece of the puzzle is the account of Jason Van Dyke, the officer that is being charged in this case.
So let me talk about that in a minute. Let's talk about what is going to come in and what's not going to come in. I'm following this very carefully. There's a lot of talk about Laquan McDonald's background, and this young man had a lot of trouble in his background. His family life was not stable. He was in and out of trouble. He had many issues and run-ins and problems in the system. A kid, you know, just you got to feel sorry for him in some ways, because he just did not have the advantages in life that most people have. How does that come into play? It's obvious that Jason Van Dyke's lawyers want to paint Laquan McDonald as trouble and as a criminal and to kind of dehumanize him. Is that a fair thing to do when you represent police officers?
Well, I don't, in terms of fairness, I don't know that that's the case. I mean, of course, the defense is they want to have admitted the troubled past of Laquan McDonald to be exposed to the jury. And if Officer Van Dyke knew about that history,
right,
before confronting him that night, then certainly an argument can be made that that's relevant.
Sure.
But in this case, I'm not so sure that Officer Van Dyke knew of Laquan McDonald's troubled past, and whether it's his brushes with the law or other negative behavior, it is certainly going to be very difficult for the defense to convince the judge that this needs to come in.
Because the key is, what did Jason Van Dyke reasonably believe when he pulled out his gun and when he used deadly force?
That is 100% correct.
And Laquan McDonald did not have his criminal record rap sheet on his chest at the time.
That's right.
So he doesn't know. And then what about Jason Van Dyke's background? My research, and of course I'm reading this off the internet, could be false, could be true, that there were 53 commendations in his file, his personnel file, and there were 20 complaints that were lodged against him. I don't know the results of all of them. I know there were some lawsuits. Are any of those things going to come in, and should they?
Well, of course the defense thinks the commendations should come in,
right,
and into evidence, and because they want to highlight the positive aspects of Officer Van Dyke and his career. And of course the prosecution thinks that the complaints against Officer Van Dyke are important. But the key issue is whether Officer Van Dyke's commendations and or complaints are relevant to whether or not he committed first degree murder.
Okay, so how would that be? So let's just say that he had a case. I'm going to just an example, that he had a case where he pulled out his gun on an African American potential defendant and maybe used excessive force in handcuffing him. Let's just say that that's the case.
Right.
Is that relevant as to how he treated Laquan McDonald on that night?
It could be relevant. A judge may feel that it is relevant, but that's not the only question, because while some evidence can be relevant, a judge can exclude the evidence if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice.
Okay, now we got to talk about what those words mean.
Right.
The probative value. You got to define it,
right,
for us.
Right. So. Well, the probative value means essentially, you know, is this evidence of Officer Van Dyke's ability or a capability to do, it's his history of whether or not he engaged in this kind of conduct. Does it mean it's probative of whether he did or engaged in the same activity on this particular night?
Does it help the jury make the right decision, I guess, in
right.
some ways, to make it really simple? And then the other side of that, or does it prejudice the jury in a way that is unfair, that doesn't go right to the issue that we need to address?
That's exactly right.
We're going to take a break. If anyone has any questions about the upcoming trial of Jason Van Dyke and what it means to defend a police officer, give us a call here at 981-7200 or text to 312-981-7200. You're listening to Karen Conti, and I'm talking to Laura Scarry on WGN. We're talking with Laura Scarry, who is a lawyer who represents police officers in cases of excessive force, deadly force, malicious prosecution, failure to train, racial profiling, and the like. I want to get down to this, and this is maybe a little bit complicated, but I think it's crucial to understand what might happen at this trial. Let's start out by looking at what the law says about when a police officer can take out a gun and use deadly force.
Okay. Well, we have a statute that is it's complicated even for lawyers.
Yes.
And it's complicated for police officers, and so it certainly is going to be complicated for a layperson to understand. But what I'm going to do is I'm just going to talk about some of the scenarios that may come into play in terms of how the statute is analyzed compared to Officer Van Dyke's actions. So. In a part of the statute, Officer Van Dyke would be justified in using deadly force if he reasonably believed that he or other individuals on the scene would suffer a great bodily injury or a catastrophic injury or death. In this case, Laquan McDonald was armed with a knife, which, of course, is a deadly weapon. And if Officer Van Dyke can articulate that he reasonably believed that he or others in the area were in danger of suffering great bodily harm or death by Laquan McDonald, then his use of force can be justified.
Okay.
So that's one aspect of the statute. So now there's a couple of other aspects of the statute that come into play. And again, this only applies to police officers. This does not apply to, you know, the private citizen. So the second basis that can provide justification for Officer Van Dyke's use of deadly force is that he shot Laquan McDonald because he was resisting arrest by Chicago police officers. So by the time Officer Van Dyke came to the scene, you know, other officers were trying to subdue Laquan McDonald verbally. I mean, I'm not talking about hands-on,
right?
But in order for an individual to resist arrest, it doesn't necessarily mean resistance by physical activity. The fact that he's disobeying officer commands is resisting arrest. So in this case, if Laquan McDonald was resisting arrest by the Chicago police officers, and he was attempting to escape by the use of a deadly weapon, use of deadly force can be, or the deadly force can be used by.
So he's resisting arrest,
right.
And he's trying to escape with the deadly weapon.
Right.
So you can fit those facts that we know about. Obviously, we don't know all of them.
That's right.
We can fit those facts into that law.
That's right. That's right. So that's the second basis that can justify Officer Van Dyke's use of deadly force. And then finally, the law provides that Officer Van Dyke can use deadly force if Laquan McDonald was resisting arrest by Chicago police officers, again, just like in the second scenario that I described, and Officer Van Dyke reasonably believed that Mr. McDonald indicated that he would endanger another person unless he is arrested without delay. So again, you know, we don't know all the facts, but based on what it is that we do know, we can certainly fit those facts within the parameters of this Illinois law.
He slashed a tire of a police car and supposedly lunged at a police officer,
right.
Did not resisted arrest by not stopping.
That's right.
And then was walking down the street with a knife.
That's correct.
So, again, I think a lot of people who are reporting on this and talking about it are saying self-defense, like you and I, our self-defense, which is someone pulls out something, I can only use deadly force when someone pulls deadly force and threatens my life. Not the same law.
That's right.
That applies to
That's
police
right.
officers for good reason.
Right. And, you know, we have, I mean, this is a specific statute that is specific to the state of Illinois. And, you know, we've got to be mindful. We can't compare this case to another case from Florida
right.
or Missouri because the laws are different for police officers. So, you know, and they may be somewhat similar. So we've got to look at this, you know, using Illinois state law. And we have this law on the books. And whether or not we agree with that
right.
law, we've got to abide by it.
And the jurors, you know, are going to have to put aside their prejudice and passion. And, you know, whether they think, gosh, this guy just blew this guy away, he shouldn't have done that. When you look at the law, it becomes a whole different creature to me. That if it's very cut and dry what the analysis has to be. Whether you come down on a guilty or an acquittal, you still have a different set of factors that you have to think about.
You're 100%, Karen. And you know, you bring up another point. You know, when it comes to selecting the jury, you know, one of the questions that the defense is going to want to ask, and it's an important question, I think, for all defendants who are police officers, whether it's in a criminal matter such as this or in a civil case, we want jurors to be asked whether or not they can abide by the reading of the law. and put aside their differences with the law. So, you know, if we've got a potential juror that, you know, hedges and says, well, you know, what if I don't like the law? Well, that's a juror that I'm not going to want to have on,
sure,
on in the case.
Right. Let's go to the phones. I think we have Anthony. Hi, Anthony. You have a question for Laura.
Hi, Karen. Well, I had actually two quick questions. One, once somebody doesn't comply with police instructions, and I've seen this over and over again in all these supposed unjustified uses of force by police, seems to me if this individual would have stopped, put his hands over his head, and surrendered, we wouldn't even have this discussion. You know what I mean? Doesn't that open him up to pretty much, you know, you can't get inside Jason Van Dyke's mind and determine whether or not he feared for his life. And if I'm a juror, unless I really think that he got up in the morning and said, I'm going to kill an African-American today, you know, you have to believe that that's how he felt at that time.
How do you respond to that, Laura?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this is a conversation that a lot of lawyers on the defense side of police officers, you know, we talk about this. You talk about the high-profile cases. You talk about the Michael Brown case. You talk about, you know, the case in Oklahoma involving Officer Betty Shelby. There are all of these high-profile cases involving individuals who are not complying with police orders. And, you know, that's, unfortunately, you know, this show is not about societal problems and, you know, how we can get people to comply with police orders, you know, but I have to wonder what would have happened in all of these high-profile cases, you know, and I think most people would agree that we wouldn't be here.
Right. And everyone should take note of that and tell their kids what to do in the event there is a police involvement. But Anthony, quickly,
doesn't it only take one person on this jury to not believe he's guilty, to not get an acquittal, but to not be able to come to a verdict? Is that my understanding correct?
And Anthony, I'm going to put you on hold, but Laura's going to answer that question.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a jury or one juror that you know is holding out, so to speak, you know, in layman's terms, yeah, we can have a hung jury.
Well, I'm going to go to a texter, and this is a question that we're all asking. 847 says, "Does it matter that he shot him 16 times instead of one? How do you deal with that issue? Because that is what we call a bad fact."
Yeah. That's a really bad fact. And, you know, I think most people, if they feel that Officer Van Dyke was in the right to use deadly force, I think that they would agree that the first few shots were within his bounds. And but it's the big hurdle that the defense has is having to justify 16 shots. And I don't remember what the number of shots were when he was on the ground, but I know it was a significant number of shots. So, you know, when it comes to justifying that number of shots, I mean, he has to justify each of those rounds. Now, keeping that in mind, we also need to understand that, unfortunately, police officers, when they're involved in these rapidly evolving and tense and uncertain situations, they're behind the eight ball, so to speak, and they're reactive. They have a reaction curve, so to speak, that they're behind. And so when they see things, it takes them a half a second, maybe more, to determine what's going on. And likewise, when the threat has been neutralized or the officer feels that it's been neutralized, it takes time to stop shooting.
Right. No, I mean, you have to explain that because,
right,
and as a police officer, you know that, but we don't know that.
That's right.
Laura, will you stick around with us just for a few more minutes on the other side? Because I think we've got some callers and some texters, and I have some more questions for you.
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Karen Conti Show. We're talking to Laura Scarry, who represents police officers, and we're talking about the Jason Van Dyke trial that's coming up this week. I guarantee you the whole nation will be watching it. It's going to make national news because it's such an interesting case, and the millions of hits that video got are going to make people very, very interested in the outcome. We're talking to Laura Scarry. Laura, let's go to the calls. I think I have Tyrone, who's been waiting. Hi, Tyrone. Welcome to WGN.
Hi, good to be a caller today. I was calling because I had a question about the statute. I know it applies specifically to police officers, but I was wondering within that statute, does it also say equal force must be used? Because in this case, we know one person had a knife, the officer had a gun, and that's my first question. My second question is, would the police officer be able to use a defense that he was not trained properly to disarm someone who has a knife when he, the only thing they're teaching is how to shoot somebody at the academy or whatever? Those are my two questions.
Okay, great questions. Tyron, I'm going to put you on hold. Those are excellent questions. Let's start with the first one.
Yes, with respect to, I think you used the phrase equal force. I think I understand what you're saying. So basically, if an individual comes to a fight with a knife, then police officers, they can use force that's, I guess, and I'm putting air quotes around this, equates to knife force.
Right.
Well, that's not the reality of law enforcement. It really isn't. And, unfortunately, the media, or I should say the general public, we've been trained by Hollywood. and that's not how police work works. And so, unfortunately, more fortunately for police officers, what is required of them is that they have to use the reasonable amount of force. And the term reasonable, in legal connotations is what a reasonable police officer would have used under those circumstances. Because we all know that, let me give an example of an officer responding to a domestic violence call. And he or she could be in the kitchen, where there's a cast iron frying pan that's on the stove. And if you have an individual who picks up that cast iron frying pan is about ready to just slam that pan into the head of an officer, guess what? I would argue that police officer has the right to use his firearm to defend that. So, this equal force, whatever that is, it's a fallacy.
But a lot of people think it. I've heard it talked about in this particular case.
Yes.
And that's just not the situation. Tyrone's second question was, and I'll broaden that question, and that is training. How is training of the police officer in this case relevant to what he did? Is there a defense that I was trained to do this and that's why I did it? And that takes me out of the element of a first degree murder charge.
Well, I would argue that on behalf of the defense that the training is relevant. Whether it's a defense, I'm not sure if it's a defense, but I think it is relevant because if his training, if he received certain training that, taught him that he would be justified to use the amount of force that he used in this situation, whether it's a knife or not, then yeah, it becomes relevant what his training was. But I'm not so sure that it would be considered a defense. It certainly should be relevant.
I suppose it would probably show his mindset.
Right.
That he wasn't malicious in his actions. He was just following what his training made him do.
Right.
After all the years. The issue, and Tyron also touched on this in his written question, he said, what about the cover-up? And there was allegations against some of the other police officers who were with him that there was falsification of records to say what happened that night. And now those people are being given immunity and they may testify on behalf of the prosecution. We don't know the facts yet. We don't know if that's going to happen. But how would that be relevant? Or would it be relevant that there was a cover-up by the police department after the fact?
Well, I would argue on behalf of the defense that it's not relevant. And even if it was relevant, it certainly is highly prejudicial to Officer Van Dyke. Because let's think about this for a minute. What is relevant is what transpired at that moment in time that Officer Van Dyke decided to fire his weapon. That's what is relevant. And, now the prosecution, and by the way, I have a lot of respect for Joe McMahon. I think he's smart. He's intuitive. I can see where the prosecution would want to have, the evidence of the purported cover-up come in.
Sure.
So
why would they cover up something that was right?
Of course. Yeah. Of course. So.
But and that there's going to be a fight about that.
Absolutely.
I would see that that's something that Judge Gaughan is going to have to decide. You know, I want to talk a little bit about picking a judge over a jury. My understanding is that right now we're set for a jury trial, and that voir dire, the process of jury selection, will start this week. But there's still a possibility that Van Dyke's attorney might opt for a bench trial, which means it'll be tried before a judge and not a jury. Tell me, as a defense lawyer in a case like this, what are your considerations for opting for a jury or a judge?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things, and I know this case has received quite a bit of media coverage, and so, you know, hopefully the defense can pick a jury that has not heard a lot about this case, nor has seen the video, but and let's hope that the potential jurors have not heard about the potential for, you know, protest to follow the jury verdict should it result in some sort of acquittal. So with that publicity of the potential protest, you know, I would venture that perhaps one or two individuals who are on that jury, they may be thinking about that, you know, when they go to, you know, render their verdict. On the other hand, a judge is less prone to those outside variables and factors. And I'd like to believe that our judges are going to stick to the law, and they're less emotional about all of these extraneous factors. So I think, you know, that is a huge advantage of having the judge render a decision as opposed to a jury.
I think we should add into the fact that, you know, judges are elected in Cook County. And
yes.
Again, you know, Judge Gaughan is 77 years old, and it may be that he's not going to run next
right.
time for retention. That's where they vote yes or no. But I think that it's going to be an interesting thing. And in my assessment, just having yeah. known a little bit about Judge Gaughan, he would be a good person to try the case, because he's got a background that involves him being in the military,
right.
and he's had, you know, he may have some appreciation of what it means to take out a gun and shoot it.
That's right.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us. And will you join us again as this case goes on? Because you got it. I still want to talk to you about being a police officer and how you came into going to law school and representing police officers, but that's for another time.
Sure.
Laura Scarry with the law firm of Deano and Scarry. How would people get a hold of you if they wanted to talk to you?
Well, that's easy. By telephone, you can call 630-690-2800, or you can contact us at our website, which is www.deanoscarry.com, and that's spelled DEANOSCARRY.com.
Thank you so much. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Watch Micah and Joe, Micah Martyr, and Joe Donlin weeknights on WGN TV News at 9. The right healthcare matters. Riverside Healthcare, the award-winning health system, serves communities just south of the south suburbs. From heart care and neurosurgery to cancer care and orthopedics, Riverside also offers a variety of primary and specialty care providers in locations throughout the region. Riverside offers just the right care for you, the kids, the whole family. When and where you need it most, because convenience matters too. Visit riversidehealthcare.org for locations, services, and to schedule an appointment and more. Riverside Healthcare, putting well within reach.
She's legally blonde and brilliant. Karen Conte, attorney at law, is taking your legal questions right now. Call 312-981-7200. That's 312-981-7200.
This is the time I take your legal questions. I'm a little late today, but we're going to get you all in because I can talk fast and so can you. So give me a call here with any question you might have. Hey, have you seen anything in the news that you have some questions about? I'll see if I can answer them. Do you have a legal question that I can maybe refer you somewhere or answer your question? We have estate planning questions, maybe criminal law questions, DUI, police issues, family law matters, divorce, child support, those types of things. I'm happy to try to give you the best answer I possibly can. So our number here is 312-981-7200. 7200 or text to 312-981-7200. You'll talk to Ben, my producer, and you'll tell him as quickly as you can what the essence of your question is, and then we'll get you right on the air. And while I'm talking, if for some reason you don't want to talk on the air and you want to talk more privately, I'm happy to take your calls or your emails. And I'm going to give you my information, put this in your phone in case you need it now or maybe down the line or for friends and family, always willing to get you in the right direction. My office number is 312-332-7800, 332-7800, or better yet, send me an email and you can give me some details about when it happened, where you are, what county you're in, and I can hopefully send you in the right direction. And that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com. And Karen Conti is KarenConti. AskKarenConti.com. And we got some calls coming in. But as Ben looks and listens to your questions, I'm going to give you a couple of questions that were emailed to me in the last couple weeks. I keep track of these things because some of them are similar. I see similar things all the time, and I hear people talk about them, and I think it's something that you might want to know. Jeff from Minooka emailed me a couple weeks ago, and he said, I keep hearing about common law marriages. I have lived with a woman for 10 years, and people tell me we are married in the eyes of the law. Is that true? And I'll bet a lot of you think that the answer is yes, but it's absolutely positively no. Illinois abolished common law marriage right around the turn of the century, so 1905 or 19, or right around there. And it used to be that basically when we were more rural, the clerks, you know, were very far and few in between, and people couldn't get marriage licenses and couldn't have those things done correctly. So basically there was a rule about common law marriages. But not so much anymore. It's been abolished. You must be married legally, and there's certain qualifications for your marriage to be legal. You've got to have a license, and you've got to have it done by a certain person, and you have to be registered. And basically, there's only 8 states in the country that have common law marriages, but even then, there are some requirements that you have to jump through in order to be deemed to be married. So if you have been living with someone for a long period of time, no, you are not married, so you don't get Social Security benefits. You don't aren't able to get those kinds of benefits. But if you have children, they are deemed to be children of the relationship, and they are basically treated the same as if you and your significant other were married. So there's really no difference in the law when it comes to child support, parenting time, who pays for what, how things are divvied up. Those issues remain very similar, if not the exact same, if you are married. But when it comes to issues like maintenance, which is formerly known as alimony, which is spousal support, those issues, there are none of those issues when you're not married, so that you don't get support from somebody if you're not beneficially married. And then there are issues, too, of property. Acquiring property during a marriage is very different than acquiring property when you're not married. So if you are a person who's living with someone for a long period of time, it's wonderful, it's fine. There's nothing that you need to do, but you might want to just check out from a lawyer what your rights would be if the relationship fails, because a lot of people are very upset when they realize that maybe they've been staying home and helping the spouse with something, and if the marriage or the relationship fails, you may not be entitled to much of anything, and you may be in a bad situation. So it's always good to know what your rights are when you have a relationship with someone, because not all relationships end well. I'm going to give out my numbers again. 312-981-7200. Our phone lines are wide open, 312-981-7200. Or if you have a comment on something you've heard me talk about or one of the issues that we had on the show, I'm happy to take that call. I have, last week, I had a phone call from Kathy in Bartlett, and her question was, I want to contest a will. Do I need a lawyer? And she went on to tell me that her father just passed away and left everything to his second wife. And the second wife, apparently they were only married for a short period of time. And she was very upset that her father did not leave anything to her and her brother, and she said she wanted to contest the will and asked if she needed a lawyer. Well, she absolutely needs a lawyer if she wants to contest a will. Contesting a will means you have to go into court and you have to give a legal basis for why you think your father, in this case, wasn't of his right mind or was unduly influenced by somebody to leave his estate to somebody other than his children. So this is not an easy thing to do. To overcome that burden is you have to have the facts. You have to prove maybe was 92 years old and was not in his right mind, and his second wife did something to force the issue or to influence him in a way that was not within his what he really wanted to do with his money. That's not easy to do, and you have to have the facts. But if you want to do it, and if you do have the facts, you certainly need a lawyer to file that. It's almost impossible to do something like this by yourself if you are not an attorney. Let's see. I have another question from Justin. Gave me a quick email, and he questioned, can I get a DUI on private property? And then he said, also, can I be convicted of DUI if I blew less than 0.08? And the simple answer to that question was that, yes, you can get a DUI on private property. When you get into a car anywhere, private or public, you are charged with the same rules as being on a public property, which is you have to be sober and you can't be drunk or you can't be under the influence. So, yes, you can be arrested for being on your own property within a DUI setting. And can you be convicted of DUI if you blew less than 0.08? Yes, and the answer is yes. If there is a breathalyzer that shows over 0.08, there is a presumption that you're intoxicated. And there are defenses to that. There are good lawyers who will defend those types of things and will defend the results. But I have seen cases, and there was a recent, not too recent, but a high-profile case in Chicago, I won't name the person, was stopped for driving under the influence and was given the breathalyzer. He blew well under 0.08. I think he had like a half a glass of wine 2 hours in the past. And they still arrested him, and he ended up pleading to something. And it was interesting because he thought, well, I did the breathalyzer and I wasn't drunk, so why did they charge me? Well, he was acting in a way that was intoxicated, and they tried to convict him based upon how he appeared, how he was walking, his balance was off, and how he was driving erratically, and some other witnesses saw the same thing. So yes, even if you blow under, you can still be charged and still be convicted. Let me give out the numbers again. It's really quiet here tonight. It's really quiet. Ben, can you make some of these things happen? Okay. Yes. Good. Okay. Okay. Ben, could you say that on air? Because I can barely hear you. Yes.
Sure. So we had a caller call in that was curious if we could touch on the topic of affirmative defense in the Van Dyke trial and how they not only have to come to a complete unanimous decision on sentencing and whatnot, but also what also has to be disproven on the other side of things.
Ooh. Well, okay, let me just say it this way. The Jason Van Dyke is absolutely positively innocent as we stand here. And that's what the law says in this country since we had our Constitution and even before. So he is presumed innocent. So he has to prove absolutely, positively nothing. This prosecution has a burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that he used excessive force, actually, that he committed murder. It's a first-degree murder charge, that he premeditated and committed murder. So his defense is going to be that he used the force that was required and that was necessary under the statute that we talked about with our prior guest, which is that he was either escaping, he was resisting arrest, he was walking away with a deadly weapon, and there was a reasonable concern that he might go and harm somebody else. So the defense is not really an affirmative matter. It's really, you know, it's the prosecution has the burden of proof. Now, one of the things we didn't talk about with our guest was the idea of Jason Van Dyke testifying. We touched on it briefly, and I wonder if he's going to testify. And it seems to me that he is going to have to testify to tell the jury
what he reasonably believed, step by step. This is what I thought when I heard that he slashed a tire, that he lunged at a police officer, that he was walking down the street. He'd been walking down the street. You know, who knows what the facts are? And that he reasonably believed that this kid was a menace and a danger to not only himself, but to the other police officers and maybe the people in the general public. So I hope that answers the question, that he has no burden to prove anything, but he is going to lodge the defense that he acted within the law of self-defense for a peace officer, they call it. So hopefully that answers your question. Do I have any other calls, Ben? Okay, we're going to take a break here, and should I go right to... Okay, we're going to go to news. Let me give out the numbers again, 981-7200, 981-7200. Hope you're having a nice Labor Day weekend. Hope you're planning a nice barbecue tomorrow. And let me give you up my numbers one more time, 312-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. We're taking your legal calls at the studio here, 981-7200. 981-7200. I'm a practicing lawyer. I've been doing this for over 31 years, and hopefully I can answer your questions. Let's go to Margaret. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to WGN.
Hi, Karen. My question is there any value or any opportunity to speak to an attorney when you're an employee at an organization and you feel that... you know, your employer is not listening to you regarding, like, say, an incident, and they're giving you, a last opportunity or the last, you know, chance before you're going to be terminated. And, you know, they're taking more or less your word against another employee's that there was an argument, and they're taking the other employee's side. And is there any, if you end up having an incident where, say, you have employees reporting to you and you have to be, you know, give them directions and they don't like it, and then they report you to your supervisor.
Okay. Let me just ask you, is this, you're in a union shop or not a union shop?
The employee is a union employee, and... but they work for an organization, so they work for a, they're working, you know, for a company where it's, they're hired into the company, but okay. They're a union employee.
Okay, and what about the supervisor who you're concerned about? Is this person a union employee?
No.
Okay.
This employee is the organization's employee.
Okay, so generally speaking, you're an at-will employee. The supervisor, who's
right,
not in a union, does not have a union contract that might require certain things happen before a firing occurs, and there's a way to grieve that and to process that. But if you're an employee at will, which just means you don't have a contract and you're not in a labor union, the employer can do basically whatever it wants to you, even if they're wrong. And the only exceptions to that rule would be if it's based upon age, gender, discrimination, pregnancy, military service, sexual preference, national origin, religion. Okay, those things, if those things are not at play, and it's just he's believing, your boss is believing you, not you, and believing somebody else, even though you know you're right, you don't have any ramification. So basically, the employer can do whatever it wants, even if it's wrong. I give the example that someone could be going to work every day at Marshall Fields or Target, and you're wearing red shoes, and your boss comes over and says, I don't like your green shoes, you're fired. And the employee says, but they're not, they're red. It doesn't matter. That, as unfair as that sounds and as ridiculous as that is, that is a proper firing. Okay, so that's what you're up against. So if this is something that's going on, you're going to need to work it out, or you're going to need to, you know, look for a new job. Okay?
It's unfortunate.
It really is, and people hate when I give that advice, but I probably give that advice 10 times a week to people who call, who just can't understand why fairness in the workplace doesn't really apply in that situation. But thank you so much for the call. Okay.
Thank you, Karen.
All right. Good luck.
Let's, thank you.
Sure. Let's go to Larry. Hi, Larry. Welcome to WGN.
I lost my father back in March. I am the executor of the estate. His house was in a trust, which we sold, and I split the proceeds with my brother and my sister. I did file the will back in March. I need to know if there's anything else I need to do.
Okay, and I'm not sure that I can tell you that by just talking to you here. Sounds like you've done a good job of processing everything. You know what would be probably a really good thing is to just spend about 10 minutes with a lawyer. The lawyer might want to see the will and the trust to make sure that everything is tied up, but it wouldn't be a bad idea to do that. Or, you know, there may be debts that are out there. I don't know. Are there beneficiaries to life insurance that need to be dealt with? Are there different bank accounts
that need... I've dealt with all the beneficiaries for life insurance policies.
Okay.
And I have had a lawyer for the sale of the house with the trust.
Okay.
And the only thing I believe I need to do is I still need to, at the end of the year, file his taxes.
And you know what? Why don't you send me a quick email? I'll send you the name of a lawyer who works in my suite who's very good, very reasonably priced. I don't know. He may not even charge you for it. I'm not sure. WGN people get a good preference from my referrals. So why don't you do that? I'll give you my email address. I'll put you on hold. I'm going to give you the email address. And that's WGN at AskKarenConti.com, K-A-R-E-N-C-O-N-T-I. I think it's very diligent of Larry to want to make sure he did everything correctly and that there's not anything out there. But I can't really tell you until I see the estate plan and kind of get a little bit of more information. And I'm probably not the best person to do that because that's not my area of expertise. Let's go to John. Welcome to WGN. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Good evening, Karen.
Evening.
Yeah. I had a question. You know, I'm 69. I have not taken my Social Security yet, and I'm planning on doing it in springtime when I turn 70. Now, my question is, I've been paying, you know, child support for a long time because, you know, the arrearage went up. I was in prison for a while. And when I came out and I got working and stuff like that, I started knocking that down because I had an order put against me to pay X amount of money per week. And my question is, how or if it's going to affect my Social Security once I start taking that on. Will they go after my Social Security?
They probably can't, but my understanding, I'm going to put you on hold because I get a little echo here. My understanding, and I don't know this for certain, is that when you go on Social Security and you have obligations to children, some of the money from your Social Security may go directly to the children. I don't know the answer to that. I haven't looked at that recently, and I think things change, you know, over time. So, if you could give me a quick email, I can give you an email back because I think it might be on the Social Security website. I looked this up many years ago for a potential client, and I knew the answer then. I'm not sure of it now, but I think I might be right on that. So, John, give me an email at WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Okay. You know what? Let's take a break. And I want to give out the numbers, but I also want to get the, let's make it the third caller is going to play my Labor Day trivia game. But if you have any legal questions, keep calling them in. I'll finish taking all the legal questions, but I'm going to do a little trivia contest on your knowledge of Labor Day trivia. 981-7200, 981-7200. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea.
Happy Labor Day weekend to everyone. Summer's not quite done, but it kind of feels like it's going to be done soon, although it's been hot today. I'm going to take a couple more legal questions, and then I'm going to do my Labor Day trivia quiz for a very valuable gift. Yes, you guessed it, the Karen Conti baseball cap. Yes, it's really quite lovely. It says the Karen Conti Show on it, and I even autographed the inside of it so that when you put it on, you have ink on your forehead. So it's a fabulous gift, and it's only if you are successful in my trivia game. Let's go to Sue. Hi, Sue. Welcome to WGN.
Hi, Karen. I had my doctor for over 30 years, and he retired, and it was quite sudden. And then I received a letter about, I don't know, maybe a couple weeks after he closed his doors and told me how to get my medical records. And so I called the place. It was a hospital in another county, and which he was part of. And then I sent them the information that there was a form that I had to fill out and a copy of my ID, and I sent that to them, and I never got anything. I never heard anything back. So another phone call, and they said they look into it, and I never got anything back. And when I finally established myself with another doctor, and they made a request for my medical records and never got anything. And, you know, it's over 30 years of stuff, and it's pretty extensive. You know, I had a lot of things. I had a bad decade, let's say.
Okay.
So I need to know, what do I do?
Have you gone to the hospital in person?
No, I have not.
Okay, and maybe that's something you should do, is to go to wherever the medical records section is and go there in person. And you should keep track of your communication, so maybe not the phone. Always be dealing with things in writing, because they have procedures, and this is very important stuff for the hospital to keep. It would be very surprising to me that they don't have these records. I don't know how far back they keep records. It may not be that they keep them that long. I don't know what the law is on that. But certainly you're entitled to that for continuity of care. And most doctors need to have to make sure that you're able to get those records when they retire. There's the same, you know, that's a consideration across the board. So the only other thing to do is to maybe have a lawyer write a letter to say, we've asked you this way, we've asked you that way, we've gone over there, they won't give it to us. But I think it's harder for people to say no or to not give you the procedure unless, you know, if you're there in present. So maybe you go there, you fill out the form, you write up the, you sign for your authorization and the HIPAA authorization, and hopefully you can get it if you go there.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, all right.
I'll try that. Thanks.
All right, good luck. All right.
Yeah, take care.
All right. Do we still have Art, Ben, or is he? No, he's gone. We don't have a trivia contestant. That's really unfortunate. Why don't you give me a call here? We'll say the next caller who calls in can play the Labor Day trivia game. Let's go to Dave in the meantime. Dave, welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You have a question about the hernia surgery mesh. Is that correct?
Yes, Karen. I had a hernia surgery for an umbilical hernia about a dozen years ago. I was about almost 100 pounds heavier than I am now. So, in other words, the doctor's follow-up was, hey, you got to lose a bunch of weight to prevent this from happening again. I did my part. And yet these meshes that they put in for the surgery keep failing. So I've now had three surgeries, and it looks like I'm going to have a fourth one because this mesh is also failing. Can you tell me where I should go from here?
Okay. Generally speaking, these are cases that are class actions in nature. So the first thing I would probably do is just Google this and see if there's a class action pending somewhere close by that you can get into. Then why don't you just email me? Let me see if I know of any lawyers in the Chicago area who are handling those kinds of things. There's different kinds of meshes. There's different kinds of these lawsuits pending. And sometimes you join a national one. Sometimes you can join one that's based in Chicago. So I can't really give you advice right now. And I don't even know if you have a lawsuit, but you probably see these on the television where you say, if you've had a surgery and this mesh has failed or this hip replacement did not work, please call these lawyers, and you become part of the class. They all proceed together in a class action, and then whatever your damages are, you would get money at the end of that if there is a case. So let me give you my email address. It's WGN@askkarenconti.com. Okay.
All right.
Good luck. Good luck. Ben, do we have a contestant? Okay, who do we have? Who do we have?
We have Jeff on line one.
All right.
Who wants to play trivia?
Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
Yes.
Are you ready for the Karen Conti Labor Day trivia extravaganza?
I do the best I can. Go ahead. What do we got?
You got to do better than the best. You've got to really be on the ball here because this isn't easy. And my husband Jerry is here and he's going to be keeping score because I don't even know what it takes to win. But we'll decide that after you're done. Okay, is that fair enough?
Okay, go ahead.
All right, here we go. All right. Labor Day was made a national holiday by what president? Grover Cleveland, Chester Arthur, Franklin Roosevelt, or Benjamin Harrison?
I'd say Roosevelt.
You know, you would think, right? That seems like something he would do, but no, I'm so sorry.
So I lose. Okay, so I'm knocked out.
No, not yet. Hey, don't quit yet. You got a bunch of other questions here.
All right.
So it was Grover Cleveland. Grover Cleveland was the...
Yes, he
was. Okay. And when was the first Labor Day celebrated? Was it in 1882, 1886, 1923, or 1942?
I'd say 1942, I think.
I'd say you're wrong. It was 1882. It was first celebrated in New York City. All right.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to switch off a little bit. This might be easier for you. Who was assassinated while in a particular city supporting the strike of garbage workers? This person was assassinated when he was in this particular city to support a strike of garbage workers. Was it Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles, Malcolm X in New York City, Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee, or Harvey Milk in San Francisco, California?
I have to say Harvey Milk.
I'm so sorry. It was Martin Luther King. He was in Memphis.
Really?
Yes, he was in Memphis.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, I struck out.
Well, let's keep going. We're gonna maybe get one right here. According to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the fastest growing type of workplace discrimination is A, pregnancy discrimination, B, age discrimination, C, disability discrimination, or D, religious discrimination.
As of today.
Yeah, the fastest growing type of discrimination. More cases are being filed. All right.
I would say disability.
You know, I'm sorry, it's pregnancy. Isn't that interesting? You
really?
Would think religious or disability or even age because we have so many baby boomers aging out now. So, yeah, interesting. Okay, well, at least you're consistent.
Now I totally struck out.
Well, this is the fun part, okay? What I'm going to do is I'm going to name the fictional television employer, and you're going to name the television series that it came from. Okay? So it's going to be the name, like, for instance, Minnesota State University was the employer in the TV show Coach. Okay? I didn't watch that, so I wouldn't know the answer to that. But I'm going to read you the name of the employer, and you're going to tell me what television show. Okay? I'll start with an easy one. Mayberry Sheriff's Department. What was the...
Mayberry Police Department.
Yep. Who was what was the TV series?
Mayberry RFT. I don't know.
It begins with Andy and ends with Griffin.
Andy Griffin.
Andy Griffin Show. There we go. All right.
Yeah.
All right. How about the employer, James Buchanan High School?
Yeah.
John Travolta was in it. Does anybody remember that? I know you guys know it. Welcome Back, Cotter.
Yeah, something like that.
All right, I don't know how old you are, but Gotham Bus Company. Who was the, what was the TV series?
Oh, wait.
It's the Honeymooners,
hey!
Baby.
There we go. The Honeymooners. That's
I
right.
I got one.
You got one. All right. How about the Shady Rest Hotel? What was the name of the TV series with that employer?
They had the train in it.
Yeah. And the girls taking a bath in the water tower, right?
I remember. I can't think of the name of it.
Something Junction. Junction.
Petticoat Junction.
Petticoat
right.
Junction. There we go. All right. All right. You're doing a little better. I see some improvement. All right. Schatz Brewery was the employer for what television series?
Oh, there are two girls. They're working at the brewery.
Yes. Was it set in Milwaukee? I think it was set in Milwaukee. Yeah.
Yes.
Begins with an L. Surely you'll get this one. Surely you'll get this one.
Yeah. Right. Shirley and
Laverne and Shirley.
Laverne and Shirley.
Give you that one. I'll give you that one just because I'm easy. Okay. Here we go. This is the last one, and this one I really think you need to get it. Okay, in order to win. Jerry's keeping score, but
I really want your hat. This would be so cool. Go ahead.
Jerry's keeping score, but there's not a lot of ink on the paper right here. Okay.
I know. I'm a loser.
All right.
I'm a loser.
Here we go. Tropicana Club. The Tropicana Club. What television series was the spouse, the male spouse employed with the Tropicana Club?
Oh, that was Lucy.
I Love Lucy.
I Love Lucy.
You know what? I have to say, we're going to give you the hat, Jeff, and because you redeemed yourself. Okay, I believe in redemption. I believe
I'm a little bit older than some of those shows, but I don't watch that much TV. So,
well,
I listen to radio and read newspapers, and
you're probably better off. You're probably better off for that. But anyway, I'm going to put you on hold, and Ben is going to get your address, and we're going to send you out a Karen Conti Show hat. All right, happy Labor Day to you.
I love you.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye. Bye. Oh, that was fun. In the meantime, we got some other legal questions on the text. I wanted to answer this one just because it's important. I had a texter who said that you probably answered these questions many times. When do you need a trust? We have a will a couple of years ago. Our lawyer said we don't need a trust. We're in our 50s. We have a home and two children. A relative of mine says we need one in the event that we become incapacitated. So what you need in this regard is some sort of power of attorney so that when and if you become incapacitated, you assign somebody to conduct your personal life, your medicine and your medical power of attorney, and then also your business affairs. So if you become incapacitated and you need someone to write checks and to pay bills, that person can do it. So again, I don't know why it would be that your lawyer didn't do that at the time. So you might want to have a lawyer just review the entire estate plan just so you can make sure that it's up to date and that you have the best plan possible. Do we need to go to news? I think I heard the noise. Yes, go to news. All right. The Steve Cochran Show. Hey, thanks for listening and happy Labor Day to everyone. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of the show.